Since everyone's gone very quiet, I'm going to say something. I'd like to provide a very brief and incomplete genealogy for tonight's lecture, which is held in honor of Malinowski, the founder of the LSE Anthropology Department, and of course, in many respects, the founder of modern social anthropology. As some of you will know, Malinowski was very interested in the idea of an anthropology of China. His first PhD student, Raymond Firth, actually hoped to conduct fieldwork there, but this was never to be. However, starting in the mid-1930s, Malinowski and Firth taught and supervised several Chinese students at the LSE, including Fei Xiaotong. Fei was Malinowski's last PhD student, and after his return to China, he became an exceptionally famous an influential anthropologist and public intellectual. Tragically, his career, and in fact the progress of anthropology in China as a whole, was brought to a 20-year standstill by the revolution, and especially by the Cultural Revolution, which Fei was probably fortunate to have survived. During roughly the same period in the UK, specifically between the late 50s and the early 70s, Professor Morris Friedman, having been supervised at the LSE, again by Raymond Firth, was emerging as the world's leading expert in the anthropology of China. In 1962, Morris Friedman, gave the third Malinowski lecture, entitled A Chinese Phase in Social Anthropology, before tonight, coincidentally, the only one of the 42 Malinowski lectures to have focused on China. Friedman argued, among other things, that old-fashioned village-based studies by anthropologists were not necessarily very helpful in a place as big and complicated as China. He also rather ominously said, with an eye on political developments on the mainland, that, quote, there can be no new generation of anthropologists in China, at least as we understand the name. A few years before Friedman made this rather depressing prediction, tonight's lecturer, Yan Yunxiang, was born in Beijing. His parents were deemed to have been of bad class background, Chushan Buhao, and at the start of the Cultural Revolution, when Yan was only 12, the entire family were exiled to the Chinese countryside. Yan spent the following 12 years working as a shepherd and then as an ordinary peasant, Nonglin, first with his family in Shandong and from the age of 17 alone in Heilongjiang. At the end of the 70s, following the death of Mao and the arrival of the early reform era, Yan succeeded, in spite of having only 5 years of primary school education, in passing the entrance examinations for Beijing University. He went there to study first Chinese literature, then folklore, before gaining admission to Harvard, where he studied social anthropology under James L. Watson, earning the PhD in 1993. Now, Professor Yan teaches anthropology at the University of California in Los Angeles, and along the way, he's written two outstanding books, The Flow of Gifts, Reciprocity in Social Networks in a Chinese Village, published by Stanford in 1996, and, more recently, Private Life Under Socialism, Love, Intimacy, and Family Change in a Chinese Village, 1949 to 1999, published by Stanford University Press this year. For me, Yan's work is primarily significant for two reasons. First, Yan shows, Morris Friedman notwithstanding, that old-fashioned village-based studies by anthropologists can be extremely productive even in a place as big and complicated as China. Second, Yan sets for himself very high standards of sociological evidence, and this means that when he talks about potentially fuzzy, if interesting, topics such as reciprocity or love or intimacy or individuality, he's not just spinning words. he really does normally have a case. His arguments really can be backed up with substantial empirical data. Both of these features of Yan's research, not to mention his focus on China, would presumably have pleased both Malinowski and Firth greatly. And for this reason, both the department and the school are delighted to welcome Professor Yan Yunxiang as the Malinowski lecturer for 2003.
First of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Charles Stafford for inviting me here. I'd like to thank the Department of Anthropology and all of you for giving me the opportunity to present my work. It is truly a humbling experience for me to have such a great honor to present the lecture tonight. Because Professor Malinowski, in addition to Charles just mentioned, is also the key scholar, the sole scholar probably, who defined the direction of my career development. It was in 1984, more than 19 years ago. At that time, I was in the Chinese, in Peking University in China, in the program of folklore and mythology, and I wasn't quite happy because at that time, the Chinese folklore program was under heavy influence of the Soviet Union model, which regards folklore as the oral literature of the working class people, which also means studying folklore out of the context of real life. So I was searching very hard to find, trying hard to find something which can allow me to study the everyday life of ordinary people. And it's just purely by accident. From a journal article published in the 1940s, I found the a reference to a book entitled "文化论" in Chinese, which in English is probably "The Functions of Cultures," written by Professor Malinowski and translated into Chinese either in 1941 or 42 by a famous sociologist, Wu Wenzhao, who was Professor Fei Xiaotong's teacher before he came to Lao SE. It is also worth mentioning that Professor Malinowski gave the manuscript of that particular book to Wu Wenzhao before he published the English version. So it's very, I don't know the details, it's possible that the Chinese version came out first. And that again shows Professor Malinowski's vision and his at that early time, his attention to the development of the Chinese anthropology. So in a sense, he's also a contributing founder of the Chinese anthropology, not only by teaching students, but also through his work. So in that sense, it is really, really my great honor to be able to come here to present the lecture. The title of my lecture tonight is Individualism and the Transformation of Bread Wealth in Rural China. The practice of bread wealth constitutes an important family strategy by which the elders in a family or kin group may adjust household labor needs, validate a marriage agreement, and control the younger generation through the transmission of family property. The specific items of bread wealth are all negotiated, determined, and exchanged by the parents or elder kinsmen of the bride and the groom in a given marriage. Logically, along with the rise of youth autonomy in mate choice, the nuclearization of the family, and the decline of parental power and authority, bride wealth transactions should also gradually fade away. Ethnographic evidence from rural North China, however, reveals an intriguing trend of development. While villager youth enjoy autonomy and independence in many aspects of private life, including free choice in marriage and de facto neo-local residence, the standard size of bread wealth has increased more than 10 times since the 1980s. More importantly, it is now the bride, not her parents, who receive the bride vows, and it is the bride and the groom who work together to bargain, and bargain very hard for the highest possible amount of bride vows from the groom's parents, often pushing the parents into deep debt. In the following presentation, I will first describe the changing practice of bride vows in a Chinese village, and then discuss the meaning of the change, especially the self-claimed individualism shared by young villagers. In the third section, I will explore the causes that have led to the transformation of the bride vows. My study is based on longitudinal fieldwork conducted in Xiajia village in northeast China, a farming community with a population of around 1,500. My inquiry on the changes in marriage transactions benefited greatly from a particular local custom by which villagers record all items of a bride vows on the written contract of engagement. Although both bride vows and the dowry are exchanged in the local system, my presentation today examines only the practice of bride vows. Locally, marriage transactions provided by the groom's parents is called cai li, literally meaning colorful gifts, but it's better to be understood as marital gifts. When I asked what constitutes cai li, villagers always came up with a quick and short answer: money and goods. The first part, monetary gifts, were presented by the groom's family to the bride's family, which I refer to as betrothal gifts. The second part of a cai li, the material gifts, includes a great variety of material items such as furniture, bedding items, and major appliances, household appliances. It is the responsibility of the groom's family to purchase all material gifts and place them in the room that is to be used as the conjugal chamber for the newlywed couple. Because these material gifts do not move between the two families and are meant to be used by the newlyweds, I refer them as conjugal endowment, which means bride vows has two parts: the bride's betrothal gifts parts, which are in the monetary term being transferred from the groom's family to the bride's family, and the conjugal endowment part, which does not go between the two families. According to older villagers, the content of a betrothal gift, the monetary part, in the 1950s was simple, including only one category, which is a sum of cash called li qian, and also a set of routine gifts such as foods and wine. The routine gifts, however, was not subject to negotiation and would not enter the formal engagement contract, so will not be discussed in my presentation. The Chinese word li qian literally means ritual money, but I prefer to translate it as betrothal money, since the term ritual in this context refers to the engagement ceremony. Ideally, the betrothal money is to subsidize the bride's parents in their preparation of the dowry for the bride, for their daughter, including the trousseau items. Nevertheless, throughout the 1950s and the 1960s, it was not unusual for the parents to use a daughter's betrothal money to pay for their son's marriage. Since the betrothal money was under the control of the bride's parents, a higher bride wealth at that time would likely benefit the bride's parents instead of the bride herself. A new category called trousseau money emerged and was added onto the engagement contract during the middle of 1960s. It was offered by the groom's family to the bride's family for the purpose of purchasing clothes, shoes, and other personal items for the bride. The trousseau money, however, was not given, although it was written into the contract, but it was not given to the bride's parents. Instead, the groom's family used the money in this category to buy, to purchase trousseau items, which were then sent to the bride's family to give to the bride. Later, on the wedding day, the same items would be taken back by the bride, along with her dowry. This new category represents a significant change because the goods are specifically for the bride herself. During the late 1960s, a third category called money for filling the pipe, 装烟钱 in Chinese, began to be a factor in marriage negotiations. Unlike the trousseau money, this monetary gift was given directly to the bride herself for her service of fulfilling the tobacco pipes of her senior kinsman during the wedding. I refer to this as the payment for ritual service. Although it appeared to be insignificant in terms of a monetary value, which was 20 to 50 yuan during the 1960s, it was, for the first time, given by the groom's family to the bride herself directly. The amount of this gift increased considerably during the late 1970s and early 1980s, along with the rise of the trousseau money. It was also during this period that the groom's family relinquished its control over the purchase of the trousseau items and allowed the young couple to buy the material goods on their own. This development together reflects the increasing importance of the bride in marriage transactions, a point which I will revisit shortly. Beginning in the middle of the 1980s, however, all monetary gifts were subsumed under a new category. In Chinese, it is called ganzhe. The Chinese word ganzhe refers to the conversion of material goods into monetary terms. In the context of marriage transactions, the term ganzhe implies the conversion of all previous three categories of monetary gifts into a lump sum. The total amount is recorded on the engagement contract, and more importantly, the cash was given directly to the bride herself, right on the engagement ritual. Hereafter, I will refer to this category of ganzhe as converted betrothal gifts. Similar changes occurred in the provision of material goods by the groom's family, namely the conjugal endowment part of a bride wealth. Conjugal endowment, as noted earlier, includes furniture, bedding items, and major appliances. None of these things was part of the marriage transactions during the 1950s. They only began to appear in a small proportion during the 1960s. The demand for material goods for conjugal unit grew rapidly during the 1970s. Furniture was added as a necessary part of a marriage contract, and a demand for the well-known four big items. At that time in the 70s, the four big items were bicycle, sewing machine, wristwatch, and radio soon emerged. And later on during the 80s, the four big items changed. More items were added to the conjugal endowment throughout the 1980s, and the trend of escalation reached a new high by the early 1990s, when the bride requested that all of the expenses to buy material goods were also converted into cash. Following the earlier model of ganzhe, or the converted betrothal gifts, the cash was given to the bride herself. Villagers simply called the latest practice da ganzhe, meaning grand conversion, which includes all of the previous categories of bride wealth. Accordingly, I will use the term converted bride wealth to describe the current practice of a grand conversion. By the end of 1990s, specifically by 1999, when I did my latest fieldwork there, the converted bride wealth has regularly included a new house, and sometimes important means of production, such as a family-sized tractor. To sum up, over the past 5 decades, marriage transactions provided by the groom's family to the bride's family evolved from a simple single category of betrothal money into 6 categories of monetary and material gifts. The 6-category system has recently been transformed back to a simple 1-category form, namely the new category of a daganzhe, or grand conversion of a bride wealth. The creation of every new category includes the emergence of a new relationship in marriage transactions. Despite the party state's severe criticism of bride wealth, the average expenditure per marriage has jumped from 200 yuan in 1950s to 2,000 yuan during the early 1980s and up to 50,000 yuan by 1999, which including a new house. However, the practice of a high bride wealth does not always imply marriage by purchase, as argued by the official media. The bride's parents do not necessarily benefit from the rise in marriage payments provided by the groom's family. In fact, the rise in marriage payments resulted mainly from the creation of new categories, which privilege the bride. Furthermore, the recent innovation of a grand conversion of a bride wealth, or daganzhe, enables the bride to have direct and complete control over the marriage finances provided by the groom's family. As a result, bride wealth has become the wealth of the bride. The shift from bride wealth to the wealth of the bride has important implications to both anthropological theories of marriage transactions and our understanding of the individual in contemporary Chinese society. Let me start with the former. In line with anthropological studies of marriage transactions elsewhere, 2 models have been developed to explain marriage transactions in Chinese society. One can be called the payment theory. According to this approach, the bride wealth is interpreted as the payment made by the groom's family to the bride's family in an attempt to validate the transfer of rights over the bride, especially over the bride's reproductivity and domestic services, or as a compensation paid to the loss of a female laborer to the bride's natal family. Another theory maintains that the Chinese practice of bride wealth is actually one of indirect dowry, and the exchange of a property between 2 families endows the newlywed couple as a conjugal unit within the larger family of the groom's parents. Based on those ethnographies reflecting the second theory, Jack Goody suggests that this conjugal endowment fund serves as a way of a property devolution between the 2 generations in the groom's family, a function similar to that of the dowry system in many usual Asian societies. In my opinion, both the compensation theory or the payment theory and the endowment theory have a basis in fact, and their differences mainly derive from the practical variations across geographic, social, and temporal boundaries, which cannot be discussed here. What is most relevant here is that both the payment and the endowment functions of the Chinese system of bride wealth have now been transformed by the practice of a converted bride wealth. In the previous pattern, the parents of the bride and the groom were in charge of the whole transaction process and could determine the eventual destination of each betrothal gift or endowment item. When a family's economic situation was not good, it was common for the bride's parents to use the money for other purposes, hence effectively turning the indirect dowry system into the African system of bride wealth. Bridewell's as a way of a property devolution was therefore always subject to the personal choice of the parents of the bride. Moreover, due to the early pattern of a prolonged post-marital co-residence with the groom's parents, the conjugal unit of a young couple would not gain independence until the end of the natural cycle of family development, when the senior female family head either died or retired. Until then, the conjugal endowment was seen more as part of the parents' benevolence rather than as a clearly defined transfer of properties. In other words, being either payment or endowment, the transaction of bridewells in the earlier practice remains an act of parental power and authority. In contrast, by the 1990s, the converted bridewells in Xiajia village was transferred from the groom's family directly to the bride herself. The bride, with the cooperation of the groom, takes full control over the properties transferred, which include both means of subsistence and the means of production. And she can use those properties to establish an independent conjugal family immediately following her marriage. The basic difference, therefore, lies between the two patterns is that in the former, conjugality was not the goal of either the older or the younger generation, and the individuality of the groom and the bride was overshadowed by parental power and family interests. In the latter, however, conjugal independence has become the motivation for the young people to demand costly bride wealth. As a result, the basic structure of a traditional practice of bride wealth has been altered, because the families of the bride and the groom are no longer units of marriage transactions, and the bride and the groom have become the central players of the new game. The function of bride wealth, consequently, has changed from a latent way of a property devolution led by the parents into an open and a more individualistic process of a property division, whereby the bride and the groom takes the initiatives. As the bride is the direct beneficiary of the transformation of bride wealth, it is only natural that she is motivated to actively participate in the negotiation of the marriage transactions. This is exactly what has occurred since the middle of 1980s. In a case I witnessed in July 1991, for example, the toughest negotiator at the engagement table was the prospective bride. She insisted on a ganja converted bride wealth, a ganja gift of 5,500 yuan, even though the groom's family had originally offered only 4,000. Ultimately, 5,000 was agreed upon, and another 500 would be paid to the bride to perform her duty of serving cigarettes and wine during the wedding ritual. By the time she returned from the engagement ceremony, she had already pocketed 3,000 yuan, and she expected to receive the other 2,500 balance prior to the wedding. The deeper motivation for young women to pursue costly bride wealth is to build for the future prosperity of the conjugal family, bride and groom together. Therefore, groom also played a role here. My interest in the role of the groom in marriage transactions was originally inspired by an interesting case in 1989, when a young man encouraged the girl she had chosen to marry to demand a much larger amount of bride wealth from her parents at that time. According to some informants, he told the girl, quote, "Just be tough, ask for 4,000 yuan in ganja, and no bargain. Otherwise, you won't be able to take any money out of my mother's pocket." Meanwhile, he insisted on marrying only that particular girl. As can be expected, the girl got everything she wanted. A few months after their wedding, they left the groom's family and established their own home. My informants told me that this case was not as extraordinary as it seemed to be, because in recent years, many, many young men have acted in a similar way, although without declaring their intentions in public. In another striking example, a bride wanted the processing factory of the groom's family to be included on her engagement contract. The groom, in this case, had an unmarried brother. Therefore, in the end, the factory had to be divided into two, with each son receive half. New and unconventional items continued to be added on to the list of betrothal gift or engagement contract throughout the 1990s, such as a plot of farming land, a dairy cow, our family says tractor. All these new items are means of production, and their inclusion into the engagement contract shows that the ultimate intention of the bride and groom is to accumulate a productive fund for their conjugal family. The new practice of bride wealth has also caused disputes and conflicts over the redistribution of family properties between the senior and the junior generations and among siblings. The scarcity of economic resources appears to be the root of these problems. By the end of the 1990s, the average household annual income in this village was approximately 6,500 yuan. Yet the average cost of a marriage for the groom's family was about, as I mentioned earlier, was about 50,000 yuan, which includes both the converted bride wealth and a new house prepared for the young couple. This means that without any consumption expenses, which would be impossible, an average family needs to work for more than 7 years in order to pay for a son's marriage. If a family has two or more sons, which is not unusual until recently, the entire household economy will be tied down by marriage expenses for 20 years or more. Sibling rivalry often develops into open hostility as competition for higher marriage expenses is intensified by the escalating demands for lavish bride wealth from each bride and the groom. Another major cause of family conflicts in the 1990s was due to the strong sense of entitlement among the younger generation, who felt that they should have a larger size of bride wealth and better housing, claiming that they had contributed to the family economy before, and what they were requesting in the form of a bride wealth was actually their own money. As several young women and men explained it to me, the family is like a production team with a collective bank account, and everyone makes a contribution to the family economy in the same way as one makes deposit into a bank account. Therefore, their bride wealth is nothing more than a withdrawal of their own deposit. Several articulate young youth also resorted to the assertion of individualism to justify their active role in demanding bride wealth, insisting that they were merely exercising their individual rights to recover their deposits in the family estate, and this was a matter of a personal freedom and independence. Literally, they used the word 个人自由 and 个人独立, which means personal freedom and personal independence. According to this logic, whether one can outdo her or his peers to establish higher standards for lavish bride wealth has become the single most important way to define one's individual identity and success. To what extent can young villagers' demand for lavish bride wealth be regarded as an act of individualism? Are they truly exercising their individual property rights through the practice of a converted bride wealth? The young villagers' self-claimed individualism became problematic when I brought up these questions with the parents who had paid converted bride wealth during the 1990s. These parents all dismissed the young villagers' excuse of withdrawing their own deposits as unfounded, And they tried to convince me by a simple calculation of a young man's income and expenses. According to these informants, a healthy and hardworking male laborer in the village earns on average of 3,000 yuan per year. And assuming a young man starts work full-time at the age of 17 and get married at age 23, he can only make 18,000 yuan during this period of 6 years. There are also consumption expenses that are not included in this calculation. So as a 50-year-old father told me, quote, "Even if my son had not eaten anything for 6 years, the money he earned would still be less than one-third of the 52,000 yuan that I spent for his marriage last year," unquote. Then who will make up the differences between the average accumulated income of 18,000 that a young man can earn by the time of his marriage and approximately 50,000 yuan that he will need to finance his marriage? The answer is the family group, parents and the younger siblings. And the newlywed couple is unable to repay any of these because they customarily move out of the groom's family to set up their own conjugal household shortly after their wedding, thus no longer contributing to the parents' family economy. So among the younger siblings, sisters contribute much more than they can recover in the form of a dowry, but they will be compensated in the eyes of villagers by demanding higher bread wealth from their own parents-in-law. The youngest brother may end up in a disadvantaged position because the pool of a family income will have been considerably diminished by the time of his marriage. And his only way of compensating for this, again, is to ask for even more bread wealth. In that case, the parents will have to borrow a significant amount of money to pay for the bread wealth, and according to current practices, they will also be responsible for repaying the debts. Equipped with this simple economic rendering of the bread wealth transaction, I returned to the young villagers and pointed out that without the help of their parents and their younger siblings, they might not be able to get married at all, much less being independent. Most of them agreed, but quite a few added that it was their parents and their younger siblings' duty to do so, just as they had done the same to help their elder brothers. Such an understanding of the rights and the duties in the provision of bread wealth constitutes an interesting contrast to Western notion of individualism, in which the balance between rights and duty is one of the core values. Modern individualism in the West developed from a combination of different sources and historical movements, and therefore can be defined in quite a number of ways, depending on one's perspective. While political and religious individualism tends to focus on social contract, liberty, fairness, freedom, and self-improvement, economic individualism emphasizes on utilitarian pursuits, competition, self-interest, and hedonism. Yet, independence and self-reliance seems to be the two most common and basic elements in all the definitions of individualism. Moreover, in the ideology of individualism, independence and self-reliance cannot be separated from one another because one cannot be independent unless one is also self-reliant. In a way, a sense of self-reliance is perhaps the most important foundation of individualism. Otherwise, how can a person stand up alone in the world? It is precisely at this point that the young villagers in Xiajia are not individualistic in the classical sense of the term because they do not meet the criteria of self-reliance, as indicated by their argument that the new converted bread wealth is the duty of their parents. This conceptual absence of self-reliance, however, enabled them to feel entitled to extract financial resources from their parents for the sake of their own personal happiness and at the same time to claim to be independent and individualistic. It is true that the young villagers' relentless quest for lavish bread wells does resonate with certain elements of modern individualism, such as utilitarian pursuit for self-interest and competition for status. But their pursuit for independence is at the direct expense of the independence of their parents and the younger siblings who are supposedly to have a duty to help them out. The disjunction between independence and self-reliance, therefore, becomes the cornerstone of this particular form of utilitarian individualism held by these young villagers, an important issue that I will revisit in a moment. Another interesting question arises. How have the young people been so successful in their pursuit for lavish bread wealth that they have effectively altered the traditional practice to their advantage? Alternatively, what are the causes of the transformation of bread wealth? Most existing studies of bread wealth examine the change of the custom in terms of either family structure, social stratification, or the mode of production in a larger society. A noticeable exception is the bargaining model offered by Esminger and Knight in an article published in 1997 in American Anthropologist, explaining the decrease of the size of bread wells and the shift from bread wells to indirect dowry among the Oma in Kenya. Esminger and Knight argued that it is the social actor's rational choice and the individual bargaining mechanism that caused the social norm of bread wells to change. In my opinion, one cannot separate the macro causes from the micro ones in searching for a more comprehensive understanding of a new social norm. Instead, it is often the combined consequences of social change at both levels that make the new social norm possible. A closer look at the transformation of bread wells as a process also reveals that it takes a particular type of individual at a particular historical moment to challenge, to break down the old norm and to establish a new one. So let me start at the individual level, and then I will move up to the levels of the family and the society. It was in 1984 that a young woman demanded for the first time in the village that her betrothal gift be converted into a lump sum, whereby she pocketed the cash and spent only a small proportion of the money to prepare for her wedding. This behavior was regarded by many as absurd and scandalous, because at that time, a bride could only control a small part of the bride wealth package. The trousseau money during the shopping trip. Next. The bride was motivated to make such a bold request because the groom had four younger brothers waiting to be married at that time, and the economic status of the groom's family was below average. Although she had grown up in a similarly poor and low prestige family, she was smart, decisive, and confident. The young couple grew up in the same village together, and by the time of engagement, the groom was already dependent on her to make decisions. Therefore, the groom's family complied with her demands because their son was afraid of losing her. Her own parents initially protested, but they quickly backed down because their daughter had always got what she wanted at home. This new and strange settlement of a bridal deal between the bride and the groom's family, however, only occupied the center of village gossip for a short period of time because villagers regarded this case too abnormal to be taken seriously. What the villagers did not expect was that in the following year, 1985, there was a rumor that there would be no extra land allocated for house construction. Those planning marriages at that time worried about not being allocated a plot of their own, so many grooms suggested that their brides ask only for cash as betrothal gifts. Following the early model set up in 1984, which was still fresh in their minds, the large amount of cash that a bride would receive was then used by the young couple to purchase construction materials. Once they had construction materials, the village office would allocate them a lot of land. This idea was also welcomed by parents on both sides because they too were worried about the impact of the proposed new government policy. As a result, converted bride wells quickly became popular within a few months in 1985, and this model has been followed by young villagers ever since. By the summer of 1997, most villagers considered converted bride wells to be a normal practice. And they complained about this only when I broached the origin of the custom. This short history of converted bride wells shows that the social position of the pioneer challenger to the existing social norm and the timing of the challenge were equally important. The young woman won her battle for converted bride wells in 1984 because she was in a upper hand position in dealing with her in-laws, yet was also able to avoid most of the severe social sanctions due to the marginal position of both families in the village community. The public did not need to react strongly because the defined behavior of a marginal individual or family could hardly have any impact on social norms, which were normally guarded by the more well-respected individuals in well-to-do families. Nevertheless, the young woman's bold act in 1984 actually realized a long-held wish shared by many young women who, for various reasons, dared not to make such a request. Therefore, many young women stood up to follow the first woman's lead by asking for complete control over the transaction and the consumption of bride wells afterwards. The young woman in 1984, however, did not invent the category of ganjue all by her own or out of nothing. Instead, this radically or seemingly radical new arrangement of bride wells actually evolved from a series of moderate attempts by villager women to take control over their bride wells over the past several decades. Recall that the category of trousseau money was formally entered into engagement document during the mid-1960s. To avoid the possibility that the bride's parents might retain this money for their own use, as they often did with the betrothal money, the groom's parents purchased the trousseau items for the bride and sent the goods to the bride's family prior to the wedding. To protect her own interest, however, the bride also commonly sent an inspector to the groom's family to make sure the quality and the quantity of trousseau items were purchased exactly according to the contract. The bride began to actively participate in the purchase of her trousseau items when a new practice called taking engagement photos, 照订婚相, emerged in the early 1970s. Imitating a similar practice among urban youth, the bride and the groom would sit for an engagement picture in a photo studio. To do this, they had to make a trip to either the county seat or the provincial capital city. To make the trip more productively, they also shopped for the bride's trousseau items. As the village is far away from any sizable urban center, the village office would issue the couple an official letter which entitled them to rent a single hotel room. And an unintended consequence was the possibility for sexual intimacy. At first, the groom's parents welcomed such a development because the intimate trip would help to secure the engagement, and because the bride's involvement in shopping also reduced the probability of wrong choices or bad deal made by the groom. However, many parents later discovered that the bride then began to take over control of the trousseau money from the groom, And in most cases, the groom was happy to give it up to please her. Interestingly enough, once the bride had control over the money, she began to spend less on purchases for her own consumption and save the rest of the money for the future use, a new development that became quite common by the early 1980s. A thrifty young woman was always appreciated by her parents-in-law because the saved money would eventually be shared by the woman and their son. However, once the young women discovered the advantage of cash versus purchased goods, many began to think of other ways to convert other parts of the bridal wealth into cash, which eventually led to the emergence of ganja or grand conversion. The transformation of bridal wealth is also horizontally linked to a number of important changes at the level of family life, among which youth autonomy in mate choice and a new form of family division and the new dynamics in intergenerational reciprocity are the most noteworthy. A close examination of 484 marriages entered into by male villagers from 1949 to 1999 in this village reveals a gradual yet constant shift from arranged marriage to free choice marriage. Arranged marriages declined from a dominant 73% in the 1950s to none at all in the 1990s. Virtually all engagements since the 1970s have been based on the consent of two young individuals resulting from a period of either romantic love or intensive interactions after the initial introduction through a third party. Moreover, intimacy has become an integrated part of the courtship process, and the premarital sex has also on the rise among engaged couples. Young women are particularly interested in the intimate and autonomous aspects of courtship, so much so that a young man's ability to carry on a romantic conversation and his courage to support his wife against his own parents have become the most important traits of an ideal husband. For the parents, the failure in arranging adult children's marriage is the beginning of losing control in almost all aspects of family life. Indeed, the intimate transformation of courtship allows the seed of conjugal intimacy and independence to grow in the early stage of mate choice. This is why, in the above-mentioned 1989 case, the young man literally taught his girlfriend to request higher bride wealth from his own parents. The second important link to the transformation of bride wealth is the new form in family division. Young couples have been pushing up the time of family division since the 1970s, resulting to a rapid nuclearization of family structure. By 1994, more than 40% of the newlywed couples established an independent household within 1 year after their wedding, and the earliest was on the same day. They simply moved to their own house. To meet the challenge of early family division, a new form of property distribution emerged, which can be called the serial form of family division. Traditionally, family division occurred after all the sons in a family had married. At that time, the parents would divide the family estate equally among all sons, and then they would live with one married son in a stem family, or they would rotate their residence among all married sons. Under the serial form of family division, the first married son moves out soon after his marriage to set up a separate household. The major part of family estate remains undivided in his parents' home because there are still unmarried siblings who need financial support, namely bride wealth. The younger sons would repeat the same process, and the family typically undergoes property division several times. A young couple who wishes to leave their parents' home under this new form of family division is entitled only to their share of a family grain stock and the cooking field and their personal belongings obtained through bride wealth and dowry. It is therefore natural for the bride and the groom to negotiate so hard for lavish bride wealth because that will be almost all the properties that they can claim under the serial form of family division. At the last round of a series of property division in a family, the parents would also create their own retirement fund by keeping all cash savings, if they have one, and their share of farmland and production tools, and hold on to the family house, and unless they had made a deal to live with the married son. This makes a significant departure from traditional practice, whereby parents were actually the trustee and the manager of the family property, and therefore, with family division, they would merely give up their power of management. Hence, no individual property would be left for them. The current parental claim of a family property indicates that a more individualized perception of a family property is emerging among all generations. The fact that parents also want to hold on to their share of family property also reflects their sense of insecurity for old age, which constitutes the third important contributing factors to transformation of bread wealth at the family life level. The traditional notion of filiality loss is ideological and institutional grounds under the attack of radical socialism from the 1950s to the 1970s, and then suffered a fatal blow by the value of market economy that emphasized unbalanced exchange. As a result, contemporary rural youth perceive elderly support from a new perspective of individual achievement and balanced exchange, insisting that they have the right to treat their parents the same way that they were treated by their parents. To avoid the possibility of unfavorable judgment from their sons and the unbearable consequence of losing old age security, many parents have made extra efforts to satisfy their children's various demands. The most common strategy of a parental investment in old age security is to provide the largest possible size of bread wealth, because, as mentioned above, the younger generation regards the value of bread wealth as one of the most important markers of their identities and success. The above analysis reveals that a social norm rarely changes on its own. More often than not, a change of one norm is accompanied by changes in other norms, and at the same time, reshaped other norms as well. For example, the serial form of family division and the escalation of bread wealth seem to reinforce one another, but neither of them could have taken place without youth autonomy made choice and the increased intimacy in courtship. Ultimately, all these changing social norms regarding the transaction of family properties actually reflect and reconstitute a more fundamental change in the private life sphere, that is, the decline of a parental power and authority on the one hand, and the development of a certain form of individuality on the other hand, which lead us to the level of a societal change. At the level of society, there are several important changes to be mentioned, which include the privatization of the family, the state-sponsored ideological campaigns, the misinterpretation of individualism, and the impact of consumerism. During the 1950s, the Chinese state launched land reform and a collectivization campaign, effectively ending the family ownership of land and other means of production. The state was able to remove the traditional communal power and through the collectives and the local government to reach every peasant household in both public and private life. This led to a twofold result. On the one hand, never before had the family and individuals been exposed to state power so closely. On the other hand, to a great extent, individual villagers were also liberated from the control of the corporate family, kinship organization, and other informal communal powers. The 1950 marriage law empowered young people in mate choice and also legally banned parental extraction of money or wealth out of the marriage of their children. As a result, the family has lost most of its economic, political, and social functions, which in turn has led to the decline of parental power and authority. The party state mobilized the rural youth to fight against patriarchal power and feminism. The purpose of this ideological campaigns from the 1950s to the 1970s was to promote collectivism and to shift the loyalty of individual villagers from the family to the collectives, and ultimately to the socialist state. In order to accomplish this goal, it was necessary to destroy the old social and family hierarchy and transform villagers from loyal family members into individual citizens. By promoting loyalty to socialist states as opposed to one's family, and by replacing familism with collectivism, the party and state opened up a new social space and created the social conditions necessary for the development of individuality. However, at the same time, the party state also regards Western individualism as the ideological enemy of a socialist collectivism. Capitalizing on the negative image of self-interest in traditional Chinese culture, the party state rather successfully redefined and demonized individualism as a corrupt value of the dying capitalist culture, which is characterized by selfishness, lack of concern for others, aversion to group discipline, and runaway hedonism. Such a characterization of individualism is incomplete and misleading because it focuses on the side of utilitarianism while ignoring the side of liberalism in the modern ideology of individualism. More importantly, the critics of individualism completely ignore the notion of independence and self-reliance. Meanwhile, the planned economy and the work unit culture in China also create a new type of organized dependency in which citizens were made to be the dependents of the state. As a result, in the eyes of several generations of Chinese youth, individualism was simply synonymous of evil because it was extremely selfish, hedonistic, and irresponsible and antisocial. The evil image of individualism, however, was suddenly turned on its head during the post-Mao reform era of the 1980s, because it was rediscovered to be one of the engines of modernization in the West, stimulating individual incentives and economic growth. Yet, there has been no serious effort. Therefore, the previous misunderstanding of individualism remains the same in today's China. Individualism is still a selfish, utilitarian, and hedonistic morality. The only change is that the previous denouncement of these traits of individualism is replaced now by outright praise and admiration. The point I want to make here is that such an interpretation of individualism at the societal level provides us the key to a better understanding about why the young villagers feel entitled to extract money from their parents yet still be proud of themselves as being individualistic and modern, because their behavior reflects the way that individualism has always been understood by political leaders and the cultural elites in China. In practice, however, it is the rising consumerism that directly triggered village youth's urge to compete for lavish bread wealth. Many young villagers have had personal experiences of working in the cities, and all have been exposed to the proliferation of modern life images projected by television and other mass media. The rapid expansion of their imaginary world, a subjective world, raised up their life aspirations and sometimes create a sense of helplessness, because the modern lifestyles from Hong Kong or Shanghai are so desirable, yet unattainable. Hence, the ruthless extraction of money from one's parents is not only justified by the particular understanding of individualism in Chinese society, but also necessitated by the drive of consumer desires. In conclusion, the practice of bread wealth in this North China village has changed from the previous exchange of gifts between two families to the division of property within the groom's family, and the bride has replaced her parents to be the recipient of bread wealth, effectively turning bread wealth into the wealth of the bride. A close examination of the transformation of bread wealth shows that at the individual level, it evolves from a long process in which individual brides and grooms negotiated with their parents over the control of bride wealth. At the level of family life, the changing norm of Bradwell's is shaped by, and in turn helps to reshape, several other social norms, such as mate choice, family division, and the support of elderly. These important changes occurred in the context of other social changes at the society level, which include the privatization of the family, the decline of parental power, the state-sponsored ideological campaigns against both traditional Chinese culture and Western values. The misunderstanding of Western individualism helps village youth to justify their relentless extraction of money from parents while claiming to be independent and modern. Hence, the transformation of Bradwell's that I described above. Thank you very much for your patience.
Well, obviously, we'd like to thank Yan Yunxiang for a splendid lecture. Yesterday, when Yunxiang spoke at the debate we had about globalization in China, I had the luxury of criticizing him. And tomorrow morning, Yunxiang is going to speak at our Friday morning seminar, and I'll have the luxury of criticizing him. But tonight is the one night when we're actually in the LSE Anthropology Department nice to our guests. And so I can only say that it was wonderful. And if anyone wants to come along for a discussion of some of the themes of the lecture in the Friday morning seminar in our department at 10:30 up on the sixth floor, we'll be engaged in a debate about the themes Yunxiang has talked about tonight. I'm aware that we've run over time, so I'll keep my comments short. We have wine and other things upstairs on the fifth floor in the senior common room of this building. As many of you will know, the old building lifts are to be avoided if you can stand it. So if you don't mind, those of you who can walk upstairs, walking upstairs instead of taking the lift, that would be extremely helpful. Finally, if I can just say once again, really what a pleasure and privilege it's been to have Yunxiang here with us tonight, because I've known Yunxiang now for a few years and find him to be a very interesting anthropologist. For me, it's really a personal privilege. So I'd like to thank Yunxiang again for coming and giving the Malinowski lecture.